We're going to look at just a little bit in the Bible where one man was given that situation. King Solomon. So if we can turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. Just turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. We're just going to read a few verses from the life of Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 3 to 15. So at this point, Solomon is the king of Israel, okay? Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father. Only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. So he was kind of, he was following God, but he was also making sacrifices to idols, which is bonkers. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" God's basically saying, "Ask me for whatever you want, and I'll give it." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude." So he's kind of feeling the pressure. He's just one man, and he says he doesn't even really know how to go out of his own front door. I don't know how to go out or come in. And he's aware that he's got to lead this huge nation, all these people. So he says in verse 9, "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, "Because you've asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or for the life of your enemies," in other words, to beat his enemies, "but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. And if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." So how many of you would have wished for money or fame or long life? The amazing thing is, like God says to Solomon, who wishes for wisdom, who asks God for wisdom, God says, that's a good desire that you've asked for wisdom, that you've asked for a wise heart to lead this people. So I'm not just going to give you wisdom, I'm also going to chuck in the riches and the honor as well. I'm going to give you that on top. And if you follow me, I'll give you a long life as well, to boot. So that sounds like a pretty good thing for Solomon. And if you go to the end of the chapter, or it might be the next chapter actually. Yeah, next chapter. End of chapter 4, verse 29. "God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all other men," wiser than these guys with hard to pronounce names, "and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom." Isn't that crazy? We've heard of ancient Egypt and their kind of amazing hieroglyphics and the skill they had to build the pyramids, all of that kind of thing. It says there Solomon had more wisdom than them. Solomon was such a wise guy, full of all this wisdom. And believe it or not, Solomon's the man who's written the book that we're studying at the moment, Ecclesiastes. He had it all. He had everything. And from that experience, from that wisdom, he was able to write the book of Ecclesiastes, which we started looking at last week. So we're going to dive right into our next section in Ecclesiastes, which is Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 12 to 18. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So I don't know if you picked up on that or if you just did the kind of habit thing of sort of switching off when the Bible's read. How many of you do that? But that last verse particularly, Solomon says, in much wisdom is much vexation, frustration, annoyance. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what is going on there? This is the man who asked God, who had the one wish, and said to God, look, give me wisdom. Don't worry about riches, fame, all those things. Just give me wisdom. That's what Solomon wanted. And here's his conclusion in Ecclesiastes. In much wisdom is much vexation. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. He got what he wanted, and yet here he seems filled with sorrow, filled with frustration. He doesn't want to have this wisdom that he's got, or at least that's how it seems. Solomon had everything, so he must have been happy. That's what we kind of think, right? But actually, as you look through what he says in Ecclesiastes, he's just peeling away the illusion that we so often have that these things, wisdom, riches, success, work, that those can kind of provide our ultimate satisfaction. That's what Ecclesiastes is about. It's about tearing down this whole kind of phony idea that if we just pursue what we really want, then when we get it, we'll be happy. Solomon's tearing that down. Just look at verse 13, second half of 13. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. That's Solomon's kind of conclusion of life. Or verse 18 that we just looked at. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Or verse 14. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. We had that word coming up again and again last week. Vanity. What does it mean? I was just thinking about what does vanity mean? And I guess the classic picture of vanity is to do with mirrors, isn't it? You think when someone who looks in a mirror and looks at their face and thinks, how am I looking today? And they do everything they possibly can with all the makeup on their dressing table and all the jewels and all the hair gel and everything. They're doing everything they can to make themselves look as good and as fresh and as clean and as attractive as they possibly can. And yet the reality is, the older we get, I can say this even as like a 32-year-old. The older you get, the more looking in that mirror is a depressing thing to do, right? And the more makeup you need and the more hair gel you need. You know, I stopped bothering with all that stuff when I was in my teenage years. Didn't help that I didn't have much to work with in the first place. But vanity is this idea of painting something that is dying and decaying, painting it up to look like something amazing. And of course, as crazy as it sounds, as blunt as it sounds, maybe even as offensive as it sounds, that's what all of us do to some extent or another. We're all just trying to avoid the truth, avoid the reality that our lives are getting closer and closer to death, to the day when we're all going to be rotting underground or ashes. Or, you know, that's the kind of blunt reality of it. And Ecclesiastes, while it might at first seem really depressing and hard to read, we need that dose of reality in a world that is full of vanity, a world that looks at the problems and wants to paint over the cracks, pretend nothing's wrong, pretend it's all okay, distract you and point you towards something else to make you laugh and get a cheap giggle out of something else so that you don't realize where this world is headed. It's denial, isn't it? Why? Why is life vanity? Why is this wisdom that Solomon's talked about, why is it vanity? Well, look at verse 15, one of his two little kind of summary sayings in this section. In verse 15, Solomon says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." Solomon had greater wisdom than the Egyptians, and so he was able to kind of look at the way the world works and say this for sure, say it for us. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. However hard you try to straighten things out, however hard you try to save the world and right the wrongs, all that kind of thing, in this life, on this planet, for this age, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I realize that every time I attempt a little bit of home DIY. We've got this infuriating leak in the bath. It's right in the corner where the bath kind of meets the tiles. And if you have a shower standing up, at the moment we all have to have showers on our knees, which is good for prayer, not so good for comfort. When you have a shower standing up, all the water kind of pools in the corner and it just begins to go through this tiny little crack there. And I feel like I've tried everything. I've tried sealing it from the top with the kind of rubber sealant stuff, and it just kind of decays away. Then we had a guy look at it and he said, "Oh, the reason that the sealant doesn't work is because when you stand in the bath, you're putting pressure on and it pulls it away from the wall. You need to kind of put something under the bath to prop it all up." So we did that, propped up the bath, solved that problem. Still, it was leaking. So we got that kind of foam stuff which expands and sort of sprayed that underneath. Nearly blinded myself in the process of doing it. Thought that had solved it, let it dry, all that kind of thing. It was still leaking, so there we are. And I'm sure the irony is, whenever you talk about DIY in a sermon, everyone comes up to you afterwards. They talk nothing about the whole point of the sermon, but they tell you, here's what you need to do, here's how you should fix your problem. I look forward to more suggestions. But the whole point of that illustration, for me anyway, is that wretched bath, broken, crooked, leaking, just cannot be straightened. And you know what? Even if I took the best suggestions and the best workmen, one day that thing would fall apart again. That is the way of this world. Everything that looks clean eventually rusts. Everything that is smart and tidy gets eaten by moths. Depressing? Maybe. But it's true, so we need to face up to it in order to realize what we can do about it, how we can live with that and even live beyond that. So, should we just throw wisdom out of the window? Shouldn't we desire wisdom? Isn't that what we're supposed to learn from Solomon, that he desired wisdom instead of the things that we look down on, like desiring money or desiring fame? Well, God was glad, says back in 1 Kings, God was glad that Solomon had chosen wisdom. Should we disengage from our world and all its problems? If what is crooked cannot be made straight, or should we just abandon it like I've done with the bath? Should we just shower on our knees, essentially, in this world? Should we drop out of school? Because what's the point in education? What's the point in learning if ultimately it's all vanity? Should we switch off in sermons? After all, this is a form of learning and hopefully giving wisdom because it's coming from the Bible, not from me? Should we just forget about all that? Let's look at another section in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. Chapter 2, verse 12 to 17. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. So maybe you thought it was all turning positive there for a minute. When he says in verse 13, I saw that there's more gain in wisdom than in folly. That's another word for foolishness. As there's more gain in light than in darkness. There's the positive. Wise people can see where they're going, right? If you've got wisdom, then you can see exactly where you're headed. But that's not so great if you're all headed like lemmings off a cliff. And that's what verse 14 is basically saying. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. So if you are a fool and you are spending all your time off your head on drink or drugs or numbing your brain in front of the TV all the time, you're still heading to the same place as the wise guy who looks around and is able to assess life and see what's right and what's wrong and what's wise and what's foolish. You're all going the same place. We're all heading off that cliff. And so actually, kind of Solomon gets to the end of this bit and he says, I hated life because what's done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. Okay, so I can't avoid the inevitable, even with wisdom. Even being wise doesn't give me a get-out-of-death-free card. Solomon says, I can't change the world. What is crooked cannot be made straight. But maybe you're thinking, or maybe I can just do something good in my life and be remembered, leave a legacy for generations to come. Well, verse 16, Solomon says, for of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. So just in case you were seeing a glimmer of hope in that, and you thought, well, there's some chance for me still to make my mark, don't have any hope. Solomon says, everyone's going to be forgotten in the future. How many of you know your grandmother's maiden name? That's impressive. How many of you know your great-grandparents' names? Good job. Great-great-grandparents? How far back can we go? Oh, check it out. Paul's got the family history thing. Anyone else apart from Paul? No. Paul and Ali, that is impressive. For me, I think it literally stops at my grandparents. I know I've got it written somewhere on a bit of paper who my great-grandparents were. But because my grandparents were all quite old when they had their kids, and then my parents were about 30, it's beyond me. I don't know their names. I haven't even met my great-grandparents. It doesn't take long before the memories of who we are, who those who've gone before us, fade. Okay, so you're thinking, well, it would be different if my great-grandparents had discovered the cure for cancer or something like that, right? How many of you know the name James Clerk Maxwell? I'm looking at Jim because I thought Jim might know. No, he's not. James Clerk Maxwell was a Scottish scientist, I think in the 19th century, who formulated these equations which basically describe the laws of electromagnetism. Without those laws, we wouldn't have smartphones, we wouldn't have TVs, computers, anything that requires requires electric circuitry, we wouldn't have it. And yet he's buried in this obscure little Scottish graveyard, not in Westminster Abbey like Charles Darwin or those other scientists of his time. His name has died into pretty much obscurity. The only reason I know this is because I was part of doing this slightly random documentary about him a couple of years ago. But it kind of proves the point, doesn't it? Doesn't take too long. Doesn't take much more than 100 years before even people who've achieved something incredible in life, their names are forgotten. Solomon knows what he's talking about. This is Solomon's wisdom, depressing as it is, giving us a reality check. And there's his conclusion. I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and the striving after wind. So with all that said, do I want you to leave here hating life? It sounds so heavy and blunt, doesn't it? Of course I don't want you to be hating life. But I think Solomon and me, as I've read Solomon, I want you to see life clearly and not be taken in by the kind of cotton wool and candy floss stories that we get sold all the time in every single advertisement you see on the TV, every single kind of reality show. It's all designed to make us feel better, that kind of moment on The X Factor or Britain's Got Talent where you get the kind of warm, fuzzy feeling as some guy who's juggling hedgehogs achieves his kind of life dream of being put through to the next round, and his family are waiting at the side of the stage crying, and some kind of Take That with the words taken out is playing in the background to just sort of push up the emotions, and we're all like, oh, isn't it wonderful to be alive? Come on, guys, there's more to life than that. If only I had dot, 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 dot. How would you fill that? If only I had dot, 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 then I'd be happy. How would you fill in your dream statement? If only I had dot, 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 then I'd be happy. If only I won the X Factor, then I'd be happy. Probably not many of us here, right? If only I had more money. If only I had good looks. If only I had talent. If only I had a better job, a bigger family, a smaller family. If only I was married. If only I was single. How many things could we fill that sentence with? If only I had dot, 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 then I'd be happy. How would you fill it? We are constantly being offered answers for life, answers for the problems in our world. Maybe even more so at the moment with the election coming up. Do you remember 10, 11 years ago, Labour's big promises for the election? Tony Blair, education. It's all about education. What was Tony Blair saying? He's like, if we can make everyone wise, if we can give enough wisdom to the next generation, then all the problems will be solved. What is it this time round? Strong and stable. Strong and stable. Has anyone seen the Theresa May cardboard cutout on Amazon? You can buy a Theresa May cardboard cutout on Amazon, but the best thing about it is the reviews that people have left. Theresa May cardboard cutout, $27.99, 1-star review, not very strong or stable. I thought that was quite funny. And there's some other ones on there which are also quite funny. Me and Sophie watched The Iron Lady the other day. Anyone seen it? It's a film about Margaret Thatcher. It was totally different to what I was expecting. It does kind of look at some of the things that she did while she was in power, you know, closing the mines, all those kind of things. She was undoubtedly a powerful and decisive leader. But what's interesting about the film is for most of it, we see her as a muddled and frail old lady, kind of coping with dementia, coping with the loss of her husband. This once powerful woman who people were afraid of is now just reduced to someone frail who people are just kind of ushering on to the next thing and kind of patronizing. There, Margaret, don't worry. that kind of thing. Great learning, great brains, great education isn't going to save you. So, if you're not a Christian here this morning, what is my hope from Ecclesiastes for you? My hope is that you'll have had the rug pulled out from under your feet in terms of thinking that the right way of living or the right way of thinking or the right things, that if they come into your life, then everything will be sorted. Then your life will be okay. Just don't fall for that. Solomon knew what he was talking about because more than anyone at his time, and probably more than anyone in our time now, he had it all. He had the wisdom. He had the money, the fame, all those things. And he could honestly look in each of those areas and say, you know what, it's not going to satisfy you. What about us as Christians here? If you're a Christian, I hope that this humbles you. I hope this, I found it really humbling reading this, getting this kind of cold bucket of water in the face of reality. We need God. Without God, life is just so empty, so depressing. I'm not surprised Solomon's conclusion is that he hated life, because if you don't have God, then you are literally left in that kind of hamster wheel situation of chasing after wisdom or money or fame and just chasing and chasing and chasing until you drop dead. And that is completely depressing. We need God. So I just want to turn to maybe a couple of other passages. We'll see how we go. Just as we kind of finish off this sermon, to kind of see where actually God gives us hope. The Bible gives us hope. Lifts our eyes above the sun, as Simon was saying last week. This picture that Solomon's painted of life is life on this planet. Life limited to this earth. Life without God, as it were. But when you lift your eyes and you see who God is, and you see what he's done and what he's doing to fix this broken world, to make a new world, that's where there is hope. So let's turn to Matthew chapter 7, verse 24 to 27. Matthew chapter 7. So this is Jesus speaking now, and he says, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." I don't know if you've ever had the experience of finding yourself suddenly stuck in quicksand. I've only ever been close to that. I've never actually gone the full way and properly got myself stuck in quicksand. But if you've ever been on a beach or having a walk along the coast, and you find the sand is beginning to turn into something that's more like mud, and then suddenly you realize you're not standing on anything firm anymore, your feet are just sinking, and it's almost kind of semi-water, semi-slime, and you're just sinking down, and there's that sudden clutching fear of like, help, I'm stuck, I can't get out of this. I'm just going down, and the more I move, the more I'm getting more and more stuck. Well, that is the picture of life that Solomon paints for us. But Jesus, who came after Solomon, even though he was a descendant of Solomon, Jesus, he says here, is the rock in this world of quicksand. Jesus is completely dependable, not because he had a PhD, but because he had true wisdom. Not fake wisdom, not superficial wisdom, not limited to this world wisdom. Jesus had true wisdom, wisdom from God, wisdom which began with fearing God and trusting God. And so he says in this little kind of picture that we know well, right? The wise man and the foolish man. The wise man built his house on the rock. And what's that a picture of? It's a picture of someone who hears the words of Jesus and does them. Someone who rests their entire life on who Jesus is and what Jesus stands for. Someone who goes all in with Jesus. Even Solomon could only point away from himself and say, look at God, fear God, obey his commandments. That's Solomon's conclusion at the end of Ecclesiastes. Fear God and obey his commandments. You can look it up, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. But Jesus, unlike Solomon, doesn't say, look somewhere else, go to someone else. Jesus says, come to me, listen to my words, take my words, put them into practice, do what I say. And that's when you'll be safe. That's when you'll be off the quicksand and onto the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. Jesus is not just talking there about troubles that come in our lives. Yes, Jesus' words and putting them into practice and trusting in Jesus. Yes, doing those things can help us in times of trouble. But Jesus is ultimately talking about Judgment Day. And that's where Solomon goes at the end of Ecclesiastes as well. We should probably go back there, actually. It is worth reading. And this may be where most of the sermons come to, because it's Solomon's conclusion from the end of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Solomon knows where this life is headed. As Hebrews said, it's destined for man to die once and after that to face judgment. That's the thing we should be looking in the mirror and asking ourselves each day. Am I ready for Judgment Day? Am I ready for that day when every secret is going to be revealed? Am I ready for that day when my heart is going to be exposed before God? And he's going to look at the things that I've done during this life. How can we be ready for that? How can we stand firm when we and our world are just like a quicksand world? Well, Jesus gives us the answer. He says, build your life on me and my words. I am the rock. And so when that judgment day comes, when the rain falls and the floods come, when the winds blow and beat on that house is not going to fall because it was founded on the rock. And I want to urge you this morning, whether you've been a Christian for decades or whether you still in your chair this morning would say, actually, I'm not sure I do have a personal relationship with Jesus. I want to urge you this morning, make Jesus your rock. And make his words the most important thing in your life. Listen to what Jesus says. Chew over what Jesus says in the Bible. And then put it into practice. Make sure you follow up with that. Follow through. Do what he says. That's the only way that we can have security in this life. That's the only way we can face our inevitable oncoming death with peace. With certainty. Today, I want you to be liberated. I know that might sound bizarre given just how heavy Ecclesiastes is, but as I was reading it through and studying it, I just found it really freeing because we are constantly being told lies. We're constantly being told good education will set you up for life or a good job will stand you in a good place for retirement. Or a good diet and an exercise plan will make you healthier, make you live longer. Or a good marriage will give you a good companion for life. Whatever it is. And I'm not saying those things are bad. They are optional. They are bonuses, they're blessings, but they're not ultimate. And the lie that we're constantly being given is that if you search after this thing, then you'll have a happily ever after. Just like the fairy tales. If the prince can get his perfect princess, then they will live happily ever after and all the problems will be over. The reason Ecclesiastes is so liberating and so freeing is because it boils life down to something that's actually very simple. Fear God, keep his commandments. Or if you want to look at it in the New Testament, this parable here, build your life on Jesus. Listen to what Jesus says. Put your faith and your trust in Jesus. If you go into the supermarket and you go to the soft drinks aisle and you're faced with about 20 different versions of Coca-Cola, isn't it quite likely that actually you're going to start to feel worried, start to feel unsure? What if I choose the cherry cola and it's actually not as good as the other full sugar cola? What if I go for Coke Zero and actually the Sainsbury's own brand was just as good and I could have saved some money? It's called this paralysis of choice, right? When you're offered all these different options, all these ways that you could go, all these paths that you could follow, actually the result is that we just get in a mess. Because when we do choose a path, we're always thinking, oh, what if I'd gone down that other path? What if I'd picked that other option? Or if we go down a path and we think, right, I'm going to stake my life on this path. I'm going to choose to marry this person because they're the person of my dreams. Or I'm going to go for this job and it's going to satisfy me. Well, then when it turns out to actually be quite hard work or actually even be disappointing, we just feel completely gutted because we put all of our hopes on that thing turning out to be the answer, the thing that was going to fix our lives. So this morning, allow the truth to set you free. All you need is Jesus. Everything else is either unnecessary or just an extra blessing. All you need is Jesus. And if you don't know Jesus this morning, the ABC of coming to know Jesus, of trusting Jesus, which we've mentioned before, but I think it's worth mentioning again. If you want to know Jesus, A, you need to admit that you're not good at running your own life, that you spend all your time going down the wrong paths, following the wrong things, things that may get you into trouble yourself, but ultimately things that before God kind of put you in danger for that judgment day. You need to admit you're helpless, but you also need to admit that you're a sinner. Not just a victim, but you are also someone who is guilty before God. You need to admit that this morning. Then you need to believe, B. You need to believe that Jesus took the emptiness and the vanity of life under the sun, and he took that onto the cross. He took the brokenness of this world onto himself when he died on that cross. And if you're willing to, that can include your sin. You need to believe that Jesus took your sin onto himself. And then if you've admitted your sin and you've taken your sin to the cross and believed that Jesus has taken it there, then you need to commit to following him. Because Jesus broke out of the laws of this world under the sun. Jesus broke out of the grave. He changed the rules. He smashed death and he said, death is not the end. Wise, foolish, they may be heading to the grave, but they're not going to stay there if they're trusting in me. So you need to commit your life to the living Savior, Jesus. You need to stand on him as your rock. You need to obey what he says. Because nothing else makes sense. Nothing else works with the reality of this broken and this failing world. Admit, believe, commit. Let's spend just a few minutes just thinking through what we've seen in the Bible this morning, and then I'll close this in prayer. And I think we've got another song, right? Cool. Let's just spend a bit in quiet just thinking that through, and then I'll close this in prayer. Father, I want to thank you that you have sent Jesus to be the answer in a world full of empty answers. Thank you that he alone is the one who can rescue us from death, can rescue us from our sin and from the frustrations of living in this broken world. I thank you that here in this life, we can have peace, we can have freedom, because we can be trusting in him and his word. Just makes things so simple to know that all we need is Jesus. And we thank you for his love for us, for his commitment to us, and that he can set us free. But thank you also, Lord, that what you have for us goes beyond this world. That we're not destined to spend the rest of our lives just going round and round, chasing our tails in circles. But that one day, Lord, you are going to take us to be with you. And you're going to create a new heavens and a new earth. And that new heavens and new earth is going to be marked by the fact that there's not going to be pain and frustration and death and sin. Thank you for that day, Lord, when you're going to make all things new. Help us to look forward to that and to trust you in the meantime, knowing that you are the rock. In Jesus' name, amen.